It's Great Mondays Radio. I'm Josh Levine, your host, founder of Great Mondays. We help executives from hypergrowth technology and social enterprise organizations build cultures that attract, engage, and retain top talent. If you'd like to be a guest on our program, hang out for about 20 minutes and I'll tell you how. Hey everybody, welcome back to Great Mondays Radio. I have today some might say, don't tell him, luminary in the UX and org design world, Peter Merholtz. He and I have known each other for going on decades, worked together a number of times. And he always, if you know Peter, he has thoughts. And so our talk today is going to be to focus some of those thoughts into interesting insights. In fact, as a consultant author who focuses on org design and leadership development, coming from the kind of focused on UX and UX teams, it is the 10th anniversary of his groundbreaking book, Org Design for Design Orgs, which I just love and think it's, you know, so ahead of its time. So it's, I think, timely that we can talk about some of that and maybe what's changed in the past 10 years and the role of or how UX folks work inside of orgs and how that might relate to how people work inside of orgs. So Peter Merholtz, thanks for finally coming on Great Mondays Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
So, Peter, let's start with Org Design for Design Orgs. For folks that don't know, what was the intent of writing this book?
So, about a little over a decade ago, I was a design executive. A VP of design, growing a team from about 20, 25 folks, and we ended up getting to about 60 people. And in my role, I was looking for resources to help me with what was the hardest part of my job, which was figuring out how to scale the org, and shape the org, and how to make it work for 60 people. And there were no resources, it turned out. And so I had to kind of make it up as I went along. And as part of that experience, I would share back through conference presentations or writing on my blog about what I was up to as I was figuring out how do you scale a design organization. And I got a lot of really positive feedback on that, not just like the content of what I was writing, but just that I was addressing the topic at all because there was so little about it. And so that made me realize that there was a real opportunity, market hunger for material in this vein. And my co-author, Kristen Skinner, who we had met working at Adaptive Path, she had stayed at Capital One after it had gotten acquired. After Adaptive Path had gotten acquired by Capital One. And so she was operating at massive scale.
Yeah.
And we just realized we were having experiences that we wanted to share more broadly. And that led to us writing a book on how to build and grow effective in-house design teams. So we wrote it a decade ago. Technically, I think it came out in 2016. So I don't know, depending on how you count,
we'll
10 years.
Yeah.
But and even a decade later, we're still really the only resource devoted to that topic. So
yeah.
it's had an evergreen quality that I was not expecting. That 10 years later, it still seems to sell as well as it did 10 years ago.
Why do you think, or what have you observed about that lack of resourcing of this kind of, well, let's put it this way. More broadly speaking, what I have seen, right, as I sort of grown up in the design world and watched as design capacities of different kinds, design, brand, UX, digital has moved from other special consultancies to it becomes a core competency. So it's been brought in. It's a new thing, right? So let's just broadly say these sort of are new capacities that are that the org is kind of going, oh, this is really important. But then they fall short in that in what you're saying is like it's they want it to happen, but they don't they don't have enough information to understand what it needs. The feed and care of scaling something of that size is what, well, first off, did I characterize that correctly? And second off, what do you think is blocking that? Why do you think that that occurs and obviously continues to occur when we're thinking about these kinds of new capacities that orgs have?
Sorry, why does which occur?
Why does it happen when an org brings in a new function, right? This UX is a new function. Why aren't they care? Why don't they have the capacity to care and feed for it?
I've been thinking a lot recently about design as a function, because that framing unlocks what I think are a bunch of challenges specific to design, unlike other functions. And one of them is newness, right? And I think the challenge that the challenge that design has as a function is it's new, so companies don't are still feeling it out. But design and per, I think unique to design, but I'm curious your take on this. Unique to design is that as a function, it doesn't deliver value directly. Design's primary value is in how it facilitates and multiplies other functions doing their work, right? Design can help marketing market better. Design can help product and engineering build better products. But design doesn't ship products into the market directly, right? Design can help HR, right? We're seeing more and more of these like internal employee experience teams, right, where we're applying user experience practices for, large enterprises to help drive better employee experiences. But again, that reflects better on HR if it's done well than it does on design. HR will advocate for design if it sees that by working with design and user experience teams, it allows them to deliver better to the internal associates, the internal team. But there's, I think, one of the challenges that d design faces is the value it delivers is not captured in a straightforward fashion. And so senior leadership doesn't know what to make of it, doesn't know how to invest in it. When times get tough, it's easy to strike that line item because you're not seeing the direct value of it. We recently, so I co-host my own podcast, and we had a guest who's been looking at the design industry from a consumer packaged goods perspective for 20 years. And one of the things he pointed out was when times get tough and seniors leadership is looking for like who's going to help, design is at the very bottom of that list, right? They're going to look at supply chain, they're going to look at marketing, they're going to look at sales, they're going to look at engineering, they're going to look at literally finance, literally every other function before they get to design as a means to get out of whatever hole that they find themselves in. So I think all of that has led to design being a function that feels to me as uniquely challenged in its identity within these companies.
Could we another let's say another way to say it, perhaps, is something that I think we've heard a lot, which is it's a cost center,
Sure.
not a revenue driver. Is that the same? Is that because that is often a bemoaning of, you're like, listen, we provide a lot of, there's many others, right? If it's not sales direct, marketing has often even said, or brand, it's a cost center and that's why it gets cut.
Right. At least, though, with marketing, or I think you could argue that HR and people teams are often seen as cost centers, right?
That's
Which is why
exactly
I
where I'm
think they get
headed.
reduced. They're not delivering bottom line business value, but at least an HR or people team has understood industry standard metrics by which it's judged around employee engagement or attrition or whatever, right? There's going to be a performance. There's going to be things that are fairly well understood about HR that people have some understanding correlate to a value that the company appreciates, such that they were, or even if it's compliance, right? Like we just don't want to get sued, right? Like unlike design, those HR can be like, if you reduce us to zero, you introduce a bunch of risk.
Risk,
You
right?
can't even
That's
say that for design. Like you can reduce design to zero. The primary risk that you are introducing, at least that we'll have some broad understanding, would be usability risk. And a lot
which
of
I can't
companies wouldn't
even
even recognize that
that's
as a real risk, right? If you reduce marketing to zero, the risk is you're not going to acquire customers, right? Sales, or you're at least not going to acquire leads. And so that would be a understood risk. The risk of no design is just not as well understood. It exists, but it's not as well understood. And so the job, so I do a lot of work, you mentioned leadership development. I do a lot of work trying to help leaders articulate their value in a way that the rest of the firm understands, because it is there.
You
It's
need
just
to
not, as broadly
artificially,
understood.
you need to artificial or not artificially, but you need to make the case, right? You need to say,
You
look at
always need
what
to
we're
make the
doing,
case.
right? Make the case. So you've been thinking recently about the what UX teams are trying to do and what people teams are trying to do and how there's a similarity, there's a parallel. Tell me a little bit about what your sort of insight or realization or at least query is in that area.
You and I last year both attended a conference called the Responsive Conference, which is kind of a next gen HR conference, kind of a something, you might call it like an HR 2.0 style conference. And one of the things I was struck by was hearing all these HR leaders with a lot of the same challenges and frankly complaints as design leaders, which was people got into the work that they got into in HR or people teams because they care for people. They want to deliver good things to the employees that they're serving, but their teams have been reduced in cost-cutting measures, and everything became about like needing to be able to connect HR to business value, often very performance oriented, I heard in that kind of context, like a lot of performance evaluations, and we're gonna get rid of low performing people, that kind of thing. And the parallel for me with design is people get into design and user experience for very similar reasons around delivering good customer experiences, user experiences, right? A similar kind of humanistic orientation. But what I was hearing from design leaders is we're being asked to prove our value, demonstrate our ROI. We're doing very almost feels very transactional. Like we're not strategic anymore. We're not looking forward. We're just trying to help reduce costs and drive bottom line thinking. And so both communities, both the UX community and this kind of HR people community, had, just a few years before were feeling like they were part of something that felt more higher order, meaningful, driving a new kind of type of experience. We really getting to tap into
We get it.
delivering something that felt meaningful for the people that they were serving. And
Yeah.
then last year, both felt like they had been reduced to these very transactional roles, just trying to like squeeze as much blood from the stones that they were part of.
No.
However they were doing it. And the thought I had was, I feel like there's a relationship between UX and people or HR that is just not well appreciated to the degree to which it is. It's like, can we apply UX practices to like our employee experience? But I think just more generally, I would be intrigued by how HR and people and user experience folks could start doing a better job advocating for humanism for humans within these organizations and helping senior leadership understand that that drives value as much as more straightforward kind of quote unquote like MBA or business orientations. I think there's an opportunity there, but these are two communities that just almost never interact with
Never.
each other.
Yeah, I've not seen it. Well, what you were describing even before about the metrics that HR, at least has. it's they're almost constraints. They are sort of a minimum viable, like this is our value. You can't delete us all, you can't remove us all the way. But it feels almost like you're tethered, the HR teams are tethered to those. And we were talking about new capacity, new capabilities, new opportunities, is I would say at the very least disincentivized when you're thinking about, well, how do you measure culture? Right, when we're thinking about culture, how do you measure, what a new investment in a new onboarding program? How do you measure training for managers? And that I feel has been why HR as a group, as an industry, hasn't been able to leap forward from this protective, risk-based function to something that actually delivers on that. I want to help the humans. If we can help the humans, they can do better work, and they can do better work, then we can create more value.
Right. Well, and I wonder if this is some of that. I not being a member of, HR, so I partner with HR a lot in my work. So much of my work, my consulting work, is in org design and leadership development, and as such, I'm partnering with HR to make sure either that my org design work is aligned with kind of broader frameworks within the company, career frameworks, career ladders, levels, that kind of thing, or my leadership development work is aligned with values and principles that they're trying to communicate across the whole company for leadership, not just any one team. And so I have some exposure to HR. And what you're talking to maybe is this distinction between HR and people, right? Like there's sometimes HR gets rebranded as people and the whole function is called people. But I've started to hear, I can't remember where, but I literally recently, one client or company that I was talking to had a people function within HR. And I'm like, wait, how is that different? But I think the people function was trying to be this culture function separate from compliance and all the other kind of risk mitigation aspects that HR serves. And I could imagine that people function has the same challenge as UX. In that the value it is delivering is seen is always by proxy and kind of an uncommon proxy, right? Making culture better increases engagement, and that increase of engagement decreases attrition, and that decrease of attrition has that you can finally attach a dollar amount to, right? Because of training costs or whatever in terms of every new hire costs X amount of money. But there's a lot of links in that chain to get from making culture better to saving money. And companies often find it the more links you have, the more tenuous it gets. Now, unfortunately, or not unfortunately, but like the reality is, yes, increasing culture does have that value. Like it's not airy fairy. You can, and that was why I somewhere in this. Actually, right over there, I have the book "Work Rules" by Laszlo Bock. Right, G Google is a was a very it's a very mathematically driven company, and it is clear that they did the math and saw that by providing free lunches and providing all those services and going overboard in providing a great place to work, doing the culture work, that had a value benefit. In terms of people sticking around. And so, yeah, you don't have to spend all that money on recruiting and hiring and spinning up new people, et cetera. Like they did the math. And I'm sure if other companies did the math, many would find that the math works out for them. But I just get the sense that they're not willing to do that work to connect culture to business value.
I think the problem is that there's a big chasm between the amount of cash that Google can put into this than others. So when we're talking about being resource constrained, you would think that that math, I mean, that book is over 10 years old as well. And with the speed at which, these start, I suppose, okay, so I suppose the tech forward orgs have adopted that. But those are the ones that are awash in cash, and you are describing. We started this conversation describing what happens in times of need? What happens in times of reduction? And that's where there's vulnerability.
But what's interesting is, and this came up in a different conversation, that same conversation on my podcast earlier, where I was talking about how design is the last function that the C-suite turns to solve problems. Culture as a lever costs nothing, or it can cost very little, right? And yet can realize a lot of benefit. Culture doesn't have to mean free food and ping pong tables or whatever, right? Culture, having a set of values, a set of principles by which you operate and communicating that and actually abiding by that should be a low to no cost lever that a company that is otherwise struggling or challenged, you would think would lean into. Much the same is true with design. Design doesn't have to cost a lot of money. Design, the whole point of design is it can, with working within these constraints, identify solutions that are low cost but high potential. But again, the C-suite, whatever, the executive leadership don't think of it in that way, don't understand how these new ways of working can create outsized benefit given a relatively low investment.
Look, I mean, I'm all on board, right?
I'm
Obviously,
preaching to a
I
choir here,
believe
I'm
that
sure.
too. But here's how, here's where it does cost, right? So maybe it's not, we're not talking about, creating a new manufacturing facility, right? And that kind of cost. What it does, it is, I would say we could think about it as an opportunity cost or an energy, sort of a management task of, you have to decide that you are going to spend energy helping humans change the way that they work. So it doesn't, there isn't a cost per se, but you are going to take a slice of your time and a good chunk of your energy to actually implement that and help them. Oh, look, these values you're going to change. I'm working with a client right now where it's like, where the CEO is saying, I need you all to be more responsive and be able to adapt quicker, move a little bit faster. Okay, great. Everybody cognitively agrees to that, but what is that going to take? It's going to take a like the leadership to explain what the outcomes need to be, and then the managers to be able to drive that and reward that kind of behavior. And so it is an opportunity cost where if you have sort of this, the sort of denizens of the large enterprise are going to be focused on incremental benefits, and they're like, yeah, I know it's exhaust. I just have to get through this project to deliver a thing. So that's where I think it does cost, quote unquote, something.
Yeah, there's going to be, you're right. There's some type of opportunity cost or change management cost, right? Because the other challenge that I think, as you're talking, that I was considering related to this, that both, again, people working in people functions and people working in user experience face, is that in order for people and UX people to realize their full potential, everyone else that they interact with also needs to change how they work. Right? It's that's that multiplying. That's the facilitating, right? It's not just like we do our own thing and hand you a thing and then we're done. It's like, no, our value is realized by helping you, or by showing you how if you operate differently, you can actually realize this great benefit. But that does require people to change. We
But
know
I
there's
don't
resistance to
want to
change. Yeah,
change.
there's resistance to change. There's uncertainty in terms of will this actually lead to those outcomes, right? So there is a cost there. There could be a very real cost where it might be a quarter of less productivity while you're adopting new ways of working, but with the idea that, let's say, one quarter out of the year has less productivity, but the remaining three quarters have so much more productivity,
That's
it
right.
more than pays for that first quarter. But many companies are not even willing to have a single quarter down. Like they just can't imagine that. And
It's
so this is where, and I wonder, this is where my lack of of awareness of the world of HR comes to the fold or comes to the front. But what the way I'm trying to address it in the world of UX is through the other half of my practice, which is leadership development, mm-hmm. right? One of the challenges I've seen with UXers as they ascend in their careers is that they often don't understand how to wield leadership, right? They know how to wield management. They know how to direct the work kind of from a creative direction standpoint and mm-hmm. marshal their mm-hmm. teams, mm-hmm. but they don't know when something's challenging to address, like we need to change how other people are operating. They don't know how to even begin to have that conversation. Mm. They don't understand change management. They don't understand the importance of having a vision. They don't understand the importance of putting a plan against that vision. They don't understand how you start with quick wins, work small, demonstrate the viability of these new approaches, develop a communication strategy, communicate, have that, you know, go on a roadshow or whatever about that and try to get that snowball to for change. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm wondering if the same is true with people that, mm-hmm. that they are very excited. They know the tools, they know the processes by which awesomeness could be realized, but they don't know how to handle the meta conversation organizationally to make space for those processes to change.
Is there a fundamental, I hadn't thought of this until you were just describing that. Is the fundamental difference in the task a manager plays, role the manager plays, and the role that a more senior level executives play is the distance of kind of vision, right? So managers are operating on a shorter term, and a good leader, a good executive is going to, like, their goal is to be operating, you know, they talk about in the business and on the business, working on the business. Like, if you're a good leader, like, you should, and I'm just sort of road testing this, you should be thinking, you should be operating at, like, I'm making decisions that are going to help us further down the road. I have a larger vision, and then my team are going to be executing those other things. Like, is maybe that the difference in skill, where it's like you have this thing right here, but you can't then just become a leader and just have that thing right here that you're working on for more people. You're just a manager of a larger group.
Yeah. So I teach a class in leadership, and there's a quote that I almost always start with from Katrina Alcorn, who, when we interviewed her for our podcast, she was running design at IBM. Yeah. She had a team of 700 or 800 reporting to her.
Yeah.
And she makes this distinction between leadership and stewardship. And she talks about how in more mature functions, you can kind of get by with stewardship because everybody knows what's at play. And so the job of the leader is really to manage, is to steward, is to just shepherd this thing forward, make sure it's operating as everyone expects. Mm-hmm. The challenge with design, and I think the challenge with HR and this kind of people, kind of culture-led HR practice, is that it requires leadership. We haven't, there is no best practices for how to do this that are well understood. There's stewardship in UX looks like, you know, creative direction. Stewardship in HR looks like, you know, blocking and tackling with basic performance development and compliance and, you know, running appropriate recruiting and hiring practices. Like, yes, there's things you could just kind of run that engine and maybe that's the job. And, but there's no leadership involved. Yeah. Leadership is, wait, we need to change how we're working. I need to figure out how to incept that change into this space, right? In order for us to realize the full potential here.
Yeah.
And so, but that kind of leadership, I think is accessible at almost any level. Now, your horizon might not be as far, right? If you're a manager leader versus a director leader versus a VP leader or whatever, you're going to have different horizons that you can influence. Yeah. But at every level, you can try to drive that kind of change that you see appropriate for the space that you're operating in, as opposed to simply kind of executing on the existing playbook and just keeping the machine running.
Yeah. Well, it's almost like you need to have faculty in both, right? Because there are some moments when you need to be steward and there are some moments when you need to lead, right?
Totally.
And so you have to be.
Actually, yeah, no, that's totally right. Too often I see leaders who do one or the other well. Right, you get the visionary leader, but whose org is a hornet's nest of ineffectiveness and infighting or whatever, and they don't know or don't care because they're off looking at the future. And then the reverse is you get that really good steward who everybody loves as a leader or as a manager, sorry, I should say in this context. You know, their team loves them, and it's really a really well-run machine, but never innovates. The quality of the work is fine, but like
Good
nothing gets
enough.
pushed. And after a couple of years, you look around and you're like, well, we're just kind of where we've been. We haven't really kind of made much progress, right? And you want folks who know how to shift between both of those modes and keep both of them moving forward. Because at least in from the standpoint of the community I represent with design and user experience, there needs to be change, right? Like this is largely broken. I talk a lot about maturity. That comes up a lot. I do wonder if there's like HR maturity or people maturity, right? There's this concept of UX maturity. Most companies are UX immature. They know they should have user experience and design, and so they're hiring it because it's standard practice when you have product managers and engineers and these things, you have some designers. But apart from that understanding that you should have it, they don't know how to connect it to value. They don't know how to invest in it. They don't know how to make space for it. And so it ends up being a pretty immature practice. And so I'm assuming there's something similar with culture and maturity. And there's, you know, culturally immature organizations and more culturally mature organizations. And then the question is, how do you get a culturally immature organization to become mature? What are those levers, knobs, dials, footholds that give you traction so that you can help senior leadership understand, oh, if we become more culturally mature, it's worthwhile. We will realize these benefits.
All right, last thing, let's end with some practical tips. You talked earlier about helping UX leaders understand how to, I don't think you said promote, but that's the word I'm going to use, their practice, the value of their practice. How can we learn, what are some of those ways that have worked, and how might, and I'll take it on as like how to interpret that for, if we continue our parallel between design and or UX and HR or design and HR, if we sort of, we're describing this sort of, there's a chain, a sort of a benefit, a benefit, 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 these different orgs. So it's like what are some of the ways how might we adopt some of those practices to help people teams better reveal the value that kind of forward leaning, cultural or people practices might emerge, right? Help them kind of make the case so that it doesn't get cut the next lean time there's a lean quarter.
Unfortunately, there's a little bit of it depends, but I'll try not to have too much of an it depends in my answer.
That's okay. I think we can
Well,
handle it.
in that design is very the value that design brings within an organization is by its nature somewhat specific to that organization, right? And so the first step for a design leader is to understand the context in which they're operating. And to understand how value is realized. But once you get past that, there are some industry standards that UXers can lean on. I mentioned usability earlier. There's usability standards, there's accessibility standards. So, whatever is the equivalent of kind of industry standards, so probably things like employee engagement or whatever, there's just well understood metrics that hopefully people have generally
Turnover,
bought into.
retention,
So, that's one lever to start, but I think to successfully make change, the thing that I see that really separates the successful design and user experience leader from the less successful design and user experience leader is vision. They have Successful leaders have a point of view. They have a perspective. They know where they're taking things. They have some milestone on the horizon, a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, that they're trying to get people to. Mm-hmm. And the decisions they make are all in order to help their team get to that point on the horizon. Less successful leaders don't have that point on the horizon. They're just operating in a very reactive mode. There's a lot coming at them, and they're more like a goalie in hockey. They're just trying to keep the puck in play as opposed to score a goal, to overextend that metaphor. Right? And so the less successful leaders haven't spent, even if it's just half an hour to an hour, of like, well, what does success look like? Mm-hmm. Where do I want to take this? If you just spend some time articulating that desired future state, that puts you miles ahead. But a lot of leaders haven't even done that basic work of having some sense of vision. So that would be where I begin, is just have a sense of what that changes you seek, and how will you know when you've gotten there?
Yeah.
And give yourself that time to reflect on that. And then it's just a matter of finding the opportunities that start to incrementally get you moving in that direction. This is another challenge that UXers have, is they know where some know where they want to be, and then get super frustrated that they can't get there in the next quarter.
Yeah.
Right? Because real change takes years, and that can be really demoralizing, I find, with a lot of UX leaders, but it's the reality. So they just need to accept that, like, yeah, it's going to take longer than you think it should to make that change. So have a vision for that change, and then be willing to sign up for the incremental efforts that it will take to get to that point. Don't try to rush it. Don't try to speed run it, shortcut it, short circuit it. It's a lot of effort, crank turning, to get to that point.
So I think what we're talking about is really telling a story about that vision, right? Here is what my team is here to do. And storytelling is very compelling. Humans are very, can be very adept at it, and can be very influenced by it. And I suppose what then I'm hearing from you, right? So I asked, like, okay, how can we demonstrate the value of kind of more forward thinking practices for people? That articulating of a vision to say, this is what we are trying to do here, and then you're step by step, and here's how we're going to get there. That is that kind of pre-budding this eventual, you know, like, inevitable, like, where should we cut? And if you have already told that story and continue to tell that story, to articulate and to argue for resources, people, and, you know, time, you're going to be set up to be more likely to have that kind of a place of power to stand from, to work from, so that you have you're articulating kind of the vision for what you're trying to do. And I, some of the people that I've worked, this resonates for me, because some of the people that I have done work for, the difference is that they are clear. This is where we're going, and this is what we're trying to do. So I think it's a surprising answer to hear, but maybe, or unexpected, but not surprising. Maybe I'll say that.
A friend of mine who operates similarly, independent consultant, kind of helping design organizations realize their full potential, is this gentleman, Ryan Rumsey. And the way he talks about it, aligned with what you were just saying, is to think of your function, so whether it's UX or HR, as a product within that you're trying to get people to buy, right? And as part of that, you need to position your product, right? You're a brand guy. You understand the value of positioning. Yeah. So how are you positioning your function, your team? And part of that positioning is brand, is story, is the storytelling that you're talking about. And it's not just brand though, it's then a communication strategy around that. So in some work I do, I refer to chief design officer I worked with who had a communication strategy from day one. And in, th she leveraged an existing framework from within designing user experience called the Double Diamond, which is a framework for how design operates. And trying to communicate the full breadth of design. Too often people think of design as a single diamond of just like building stuff, but the double diamond reflects on the importance of the strategic work up front before you build. And that was some part of her communication strategy for 2 years. Every conversation she had with anyone around her, she would communicate, like not just in design, but throughout the company. She would use the double diamond as just a, because it was a simple framework that allowed other people in to understand what she was, the potential that her team had. Anyone within design and user experience knows the double diamond is somewhat reductive, but when you're trying to communicate to people outside of user
You need
experience,
to.
it's good enough to broaden the lens a bit.
Yeah.
And so the same thing I think for HR, right? What are, another way to think about it is like political talking points, right? What are just two or three messages that you are going to share at every opportunity that you have to communicate what your team is about as you are positioning them, as you are marketing your team as if it was a product in the marketplace.
I love that. I heard once, we all kind of know that, like, in order to get someone to hear something, you have to, like, sell them seven times or whatever the number is. And I heard this little kind of like, only when people go, okay, here comes Miss Double Diamond, when they start making fun of you for it, right? Because you say it so often, have you succeeded? And I think that what that's what you're talking about, right? Okay, here comes Mr.
Exactly.
Safety, or here comes Mr. It's like, culture is everything, or whatever it might be. Then you're like, okay, now I can move on to my next strategic impulse, right? Like, or plan. So to me, that's, I think, what is really interesting. This has been a really fascinating conversation, Peter. You and I have had hours and hours of conversations. We're only going to capture 45 minutes of it here, but it was amazing. Thank you so much, Peter
My pleasure.
Merholt. If you want to learn more about Peter's work as a design leader and working with design leaders, you can check out his website, petermerholtz.com, PETERMERHOLZ.com. And there's plenty there, lots of good content. Hey, Peter, thanks for spending some time with me and getting on Great Mondays Radio.
My pleasure. This was fantastic and look forward to hearing from your community. It's a different one than I tend to engage with, so happy to keep the dialogue going.
Awesome. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Great Mondays Radio. Hey, if you want to be a guest, head over to radio.greatmondays.com. And if you think this episode was interesting and your friends and fans would enjoy it, please share on social media. And if you want to get more people to understand the power of company culture in business today, please rate and review Great Mondays Radio on your podcast feed. It really helps us reach more people. If you want to hear more candid conversations with culture leaders, subscribe to Great Mondays Radio. I'd love to connect with you. Find me on LinkedIn at AKA Josh Levine, on YouTube at Great Mondays. And you can always email me, josh@greatmondays.com. Find out more about our work with hypergrowth technology and social enterprise organizations at greatmondays.com. I'm Josh Levine. Thanks for listening to Great Mondays Radio.